So, Jesus talks about coming to cause division, which I think raises an interesting question. Whatever happened to peace? If you went out into the streets of Tamworth and found a random 100 people, if you would find a random 100 people at this time of night, and you asked them why Jesus came into the world, I wonder what answers you would get. You might get lots of different answers. You might be told that he came to help people. You might be told that he came to show us what God was like. You might be told that he came to show us a different way of living. If you ask them what we found in the Bible about the birth of Jesus, you might get some different answers. You might get some blank stares, as people more and more don't know the answers to these questions. But you might get told that it was in Bethlehem. You might get told that his mother was Mary. You might get told that shepherds and wise men came to visit him, that Herod was not pleased, and that the angels promised peace. But it's the last one, this promise of peace, that doesn't seem to be consistent with what Jesus is saying here. We have this idea about angels promising peace on earth as Jesus is born. It's a theme that comes up time and time again at this time of year. But Jesus is making it abundantly clear that he doesn't see this as his mission. Or at least not all of its mission, because the opposite is true. And in verse 34, he says very clearly, "Do not suppose that I've come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword." What is going on? Did the angels get it wrong? Has something changed? Did writers of carols promise too much? Because if you look at our carols, they talk about this. "O Little Town of Bethlehem," says, "has morning stars speaking about peace to men on earth. Hark, the herald angels sing." They sing about peace on earth, and so on. And incidentally, this is not me having a go at the carols we sing. They contain lots of important and valuable insights into why Jesus came to earth, and they call us to celebrate that. But in these examples, in these carols, it is possible that a detail is missing. Because if you found one of our church Bibles and turned to Luke's Gospel chapter 2, you would find that what the angels said was this: "Glory to God in the highest heaven, and on earth peace to those on whom his favour rests." So Luke doesn't seem to be saying that peace is coming to everyone on earth, but just to those on whom God's favour rests. So I started to wonder, as I do, why carol writers didn't in general refer to this, why they just talked about peace. And I think it's probably due to the Bible translations that were in use at the time that most of these carols were written. Because some English translations of the Bible, and the ones that were in use when these carols were written, don't include the phrase about those on whom his favour rests, but have peace on earth, goodwill toward men. So the carol singers got the words from the Bible, which is always a good thing to do. Why are they different? Different translations are based on slightly different Greek texts, and the actual difference that causes one or the other is actually just one letter in one word. So it's not a big difference, but we see these differences in translations. And so we get these different ideas that are the angels saying there's going to be peace, or are they saying there's going to be peace to those on whom his favour rests? I don't want to base too much on that or argue which translation is right, but there's something to think about there. That maybe this peace just extends to those who are in a relationship with God in some way. It needs to be received. And whichever translation we think captures the words of the angels best, we do see this idea being demonstrated later in the life and the story of Jesus. Because the peace that Jesus came to bring, came to offer, came to make available to all, was rejected by those to whom he came. Towards the end of his life on earth, as Jesus approaches Jerusalem, Luke again tells us that the crowd greet him as the coming king. And in Luke 19, remember the triumphant entry into Jerusalem that we celebrate on Palm Sunday. The crowd greet Jesus with the words, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest." Their words, as they welcome Jesus as king, nearly echo the words of the angels as they welcomed his birth. God is still being glorified, but the peace is now recognized as being in heaven, not on earth. Something seems to have changed. And a couple of verses later, Jesus, with tears in his eyes, points out that this peace on earth is still available. As he approached Jerusalem, it says, and saw the city, he wept over it and said, "If you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace. But now it is hidden from your eyes." He could have brought them peace, even at that late hour, but they were not going to receive it. They were not going to accept him. They were not going to experience that peace. And so the offer of peace that we see heralded as Jesus was born was lost as people rejected Jesus. And it's the consequence of this that Jesus is speaking about in our passage, that those who do receive him will find themselves on the opposite side from those who don't. So recognizing that this worldwide peace that was on offer has been rejected, Jesus makes it plain that he is now a divisive force. He's going to cause division. He is calling people to follow him in the full knowledge that this will disrupt existing relationships. And he does this because he demands the place of primary importance in someone's life. Verse 32 tells us he's looking for people who are prepared to say that they belong to him. Verse 37 tells us he's looking for people who see him as more important than family members. Verse 38 tells us he is looking for people who are prepared to follow him, whatever the cost. And he's doing this on two levels. He's looking for this in the lives of his followers, the ones he's sending out. Because these words appear at a time when Jesus is talking to a group of people that he's going to send out into the world to tell others about him. And he's expecting his followers to make it clear that he's sending them. To those he's sending, that following Jesus changes things. And this is so different to how our society would like to think about faith today. Because our society calls on faith to be private. Something between an individual and a God, however we understand that God. And everyone should be free to believe what they want, so long as it doesn't impact anyone or anything else. But this is so far removed from what Jesus is calling for. He is looking for people who are prepared to put him front and centre of their lives, and for that sense of priority to change everything. And we've looked at some of those ideas recently in our discipleship series, so we're just going to look at them briefly here and explore a few different perspectives. And in verse 32 and 33, Jesus presents two options. We can acknowledge him, which is a positive act, something we do, or we can disown him, which is a negative act. And Jesus does not speak about a neutral option, it's as though we do one or the other. And here, I don't think Jesus is focusing on a private relationship we have with him, where we recognize who he is where we believe in him, where we welcome him into our lives. He's looking for more. That we speak publicly about what Jesus means to us. And the other side of that coin is that we don't say or do anything that denies the relationship we have with Jesus. And this raises some challenging questions. When was the last time we told someone who didn't believe in Jesus that we do? In a way that communicates truth. When we are questioned about Jesus and our faith in him, how do we respond? Do we, by our silence, leave people with no idea that Jesus is important to us? I hope I learned this lesson the hard way about 10 years ago when I was leaving the world of IT and starting to go and train to be a Baptist minister. And there was a point when I had to tell my work colleagues that this was the plan, and I had a wide range of responses from them. But there were also some people in another company, a company that I had been working with on behalf of my company for many years, that I'd got to know well, and it was important that I explained to them what was going on. So I told them what was happening. And one of them, a guy that I'd worked with closely for many, many years, a sort of opposite number, came up to me and said, "So you're going to train to be a minister?" I said, "Yes." He said, "It would have been so good if I'd known that you were a Christian. Because I am as well. And we could have spoken about that." And I realized that in the 4 or 5 years that I spent with this guy, I had done nothing to give him any idea that I had this relationship with Jesus. And I don't want to be there again. But Jesus is challenging us to say, do we actually acknowledge him? Or do we, even by our silence, disown him? So there's a question. How do we acknowledge Jesus? And then it goes on to say, in verse 34 to 37, you've got to give me my rightful place. You know, telling non-believing family members that we are following Jesus can lead to many different reactions. "I'm so pleased for you that you found something that will help you. If it works for you, that's fine, but please don't talk to me about it. That's okay, but it cannot be allowed to change anything in our family. You are no longer welcome in this house. You have to leave now." A few years ago, Joe and I and a few others went on a trip to Israel. And we spent a lot of time with the Israeli guide who was taking us around and showing us the sights. And his knowledge, his insight, his understanding of the country, the geography, the history, but also the rich understanding of all that God had done in that land was amazing. And we got to know something of his story. His father was a strict Jewish rabbi, and from an early age he'd been taught and brought up to know all the stories and the beliefs from what we have as the Old Testament. And he was going to become a rabbi in turn. But through some very powerful experiences in his life, which initially left him paralyzed, but then was powerfully healed and transformed by somebody praying with him, and through the work of the Spirit in his life, he came to know Jesus for himself. And so he added to his breadth of knowledge a personal relationship with Jesus. And some of the stories he could tell, some of the insights he could share were wonderful. When he went home and told his parents, they prepared his funeral because he was dead to them. That's what it cost him. He had to leave his home. He had to start a new life because of this relationship with Jesus. We get different reactions. And depending on this reaction, new believers might be tempted to say nothing. But while that is understandable, it can lead to Jesus just having to fit in and not to have the place that he demands. And Jesus shows he understands the problem. He refers to some words from Micah 7:6 about divisions in the family. But if we were to read that particular passage, we'd find the context there is very, very different. Because in Micah 7, the prophet is bemoaning the way the nation is behaving. He's recognizing the sin that is all around. He's recognizing the corruption. He's recognizing the way the rulers have turned against God, the way in which they have led the people astray. There are many things going on in Micah 7 that is not good. And what the prophet is bemoaning is that situation. And he says, the verse that Jesus is quoting, family members are opposed to others in their family. And that was in the world where family came first. Family was so, so important in Israel, much more than we can grasp in our context. And the prophet was saying, everything is going wrong, everything is breaking down. And because of that, there's division. Jesus takes these words and says that because of him and because of his actions, these structures are going to break down again, but for very different reasons. They're going to break down because he is coming into the middle of them. And that will cause divisions and problems. And it's something people experience. And it brings into sharp focus the reality that when Jesus calls us to follow him, it's not primarily about helping us out in our lives, although he does bless in amazing ways, but it's about putting him first. And for his priorities to become our priorities, even when that goes against those whom we love. It's not that we're to love our family any less, but it is that we are to love Jesus more. And with him taking priority, that can cause problems. Later in this gospel, Peter, one of the ones that Jesus in this story is preparing to send out, speaks about having left everything to follow Jesus. And Jesus responds by saying that they and all who are prepared to put Jesus first will receive much blessing and enter into the experience of eternal life. It's a hard thing to do. It's not natural. And Jesus seems to recognize that. And many choose not to do so. And when we make that choice, we're unable to enter fully into all that Jesus has planned for us. This is an uncompromising message. It would have been shocking and challenging to the people Jesus was speaking to then, just as it is to us today. And the easy option is to step back from it, to not do anything that would upset our family, those who are close to us, to not say anything about the impact that following Jesus might have. In the time of Micah, the tension in family structures and relationships was a consequence of sin and turning away from God. Here, in the words of Jesus, it comes as something powerfully positive of someone coming to believe in Jesus and for Jesus to make a difference in their lives. And the tension this does introduce into family relationships can be for good, as those whom we love recognize the positive change that Jesus is making in our lives and want to experience it as well. if we keep quiet, if we don't disrupt anything, then that opportunity is seriously reduced. It is through these divisions that real godly peace can be found as other family members come to know Jesus for themselves as well. And then in verse 38, Jesus goes on to lay another challenge about picking up a cross and carrying that cross to follow him. And we've talked about that image a few times over the last few months and seen that it's an indication of being totally committed to Jesus, of being prepared to follow his example, of being prepared to carry any burden that he calls us to do. It's a demonstration of the public nature of our faith as it becomes visible for all to see. What cross are we carrying? Or alternatively, what is holding us back from really fully following Jesus? We have all seen Christmas cards with a smiling baby in a manger, with proud parents looking on, with shepherds and angels and wise men all around. And it's nice, it's comforting, it brings hope, and it's important. It speaks about God having come into the world. It speaks about God becoming one of us. And it is a wonderful message, and it's one we celebrate particularly at this time of year. But we don't see cards telling the message that the man into whom that baby developed spoke about here. Because these words are not easy. These words are not comforting. These words are full of challenge. And at this time of Advent, as we prepare and wait for Christmas, it's important that we recognise and engage with both pictures. That we rejoice in the reality that God has not left us alone, that God has come to us, that God offers us peace through his Son. Let's hold on to that. But we also need to recognise that that Son calls for the first place in our lives, whatever that might cost, and that we rejoice in and accept that reality as well. Too many people in our world today will celebrate the birth of this baby, but will ignore the challenging claims of the man. Let's not be those people, but let's fully embrace every aspect of who he is and how he calls us to live. Let's also recognise that we only do this in the power of God. As Jesus prepared to send out his followers, which is what this chapter is talking about, he gave them authority. He spoke about the Spirit giving them words to speak when they faced opposition. He speaks about eternal rewards to look forward to. He speaks about the deep care that his Father will shower upon them. Jesus calls us to do something that is deeply challenging and hard. And through his Spirit, he gives us the power and the ability to do it. Let's rest in him. Let's receive from him. Let's be empowered by his Spirit. And let's live for him, whatever it costs. Let's pray.